This weekend starts right after this. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Coronavirus tips fall on deaf ears. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
The CDC suggests staying home to avoid coronavirus, but not all workers have that luxury. Find out who they are.
More fitness clubs embrace a strategy that shows how short workouts can provide health benefits in a fraction of the time.
A World War II vet stuns the crowd at the Army-Navy basketball game at West Point. Hear what he did.
And ice fishing businesses struggling this winter in Minnesota.
Yeah, this was just a terrible year up in northern Minnesota. Ice fishing is a huge business up there, and they just got too much snow. It blanketed the ice early on, and so the ice wouldn't grow because the cold air couldn't get to it. And then eventually they got a huge storm right after Christmas, and that cracked the ice, which allowed the water to seep in, and you basically had about 2 feet of slush out there.
Wall Street Journal reporter Joe Barrett on too much slush, making ice fishing risky. The CDC, as you probably have heard, has a handful of recommendations to slow a coronavirus spread. One of them is stay home from work if you get sick. But that's easier said than done for some workers, especially those in the service industry like restaurants, childcare, retail, or the gig economy. It's a story by Margot Sanger-Katz, correspondent for The New York Times, where she writes for a site called The Upshot. Margot, what have you found?
If you listen to what public health officials are recommending people to do in order to prevent the spread of this disease as it enters communities, is they're saying, please work from home if you can. If you're sick, stay home sick from work. Try to avoid interacting with a lot of people. And these are pieces of advice that are much easier for certain people in our economy to take than others. You know, for someone like me, a lot of my work is done by the phone and using a computer. It may be easier for me to work from home, but someone who works in a service industry job where they have to physically be in a place, say someone who is preparing food in a restaurant, for example, that person doesn't have the ability to work from home. And what my colleagues and I found when we were reporting this story is that those kinds of workers, workers who tend to earn the least money and who have the least flexibility in where they work, they are also people who tend to have the least access to paid sick leave. So that means that if they're feeling ill and want to stay home, they might have to sacrifice a day's worth of pay, and they could maybe even lose their jobs if they stay out for a few days. And so that raises concerns that these kind of poor working class communities may be at higher risk for getting sick from this disease than more affluent people who have more flexibility in how they work and live.
Yeah, I know you spoke to a couple of folks for this story. Explain one of the anecdotes with one of these workers.
Yeah, so, you know, we talked with one woman who told us that she is very concerned, you know, if she has to stay home to, if she's feeling unwell, or if her child, say the schools are closed and she has to take care of her child, you know, she would have to lose $100 in pay for the day off, and that she feels a lot of pressure because the restaurant where she works, they don't necessarily have a backup person that they can call in to fill up for her. And so she's worried that they may be angry at her or that they may have trouble even keeping their doors open if she's unable to go to work. And you could just see how these kinds of experiences are relatively common across a lot of different kinds of employment. We didn't, for our story, speak with someone in the home health care industry, but that seems like another place where, you know, if you're a person whose job is to take care of a sick and vulnerable person, you know, there is real pressure on you to show up to work because your client really needs you. On the other hand, if you're unwell and you show up and you make someone sick who is unwell, who is vulnerable, you know, that could really put them at risk for further disease. So I think we're going to see a lot more of these kinds of stories and people struggling to counterbalance these various considerations as the coronavirus becomes more mainstream.
We're speaking with Margot Sanger-Katz, correspondent at The New York Times. Her piece is called Avoiding Coronavirus May Be a Luxury Some Workers Can't Afford. It's not always the same story, though, in other countries.
Yeah, that's right. The United States is relatively uncommon in not having a national standard for paid sick leave. So in most other countries, when you're sick, if you want to stay home from work, you are entitled to get paid and you are protected from being fired from your job. And so that means that in other countries, people work when they're sick much less frequently in the United States. There's been an interesting set of experiments that have been done recently because a number of states and cities in the United States have passed mandates that tell employers you need to pay for some sick leave for your workers. And by comparing what happened in the places that had sick leave to the places that didn't have sick leave, the researchers could actually show really dramatic reductions in the number of flu illnesses throughout the community. So in states that had mandatory sick leave policies, 11% fewer people got the flu in the first year of that policy than in states that didn't have sick leave. So I think what this work shows is that sick leave is, of course, a benefit to the individual worker who is going to get paid if they can't go into work, but there may actually be some kind of broader society-wide benefit to giving people sick leave because when people come into work sick, they tend to pass their illness on to other people who then get sick themselves.
Could an argument be made that you have perhaps a slightly greater chance of getting sick if you interact with folks who work in the service industry?
I mean, I don't know that I would go that far. We don't know exactly, you know, who has contracted this illness right now and exactly how it's going to spread.
Thanks, Margo. Margo Sanger-Katz, correspondent for The New York Times. 12 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. According to ZipRecruiter research, nearly three-quarters of employers say they're finding it difficult to fill open spots. So 68% have raised their wages, 23% have increased benefits. If you have a difficult role to fill, no matter what your industry, hire with ZipRecruiter. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. ZipRecruiter makes hiring easy by sending your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites. Using their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter then scans thousands of resumes to find people with just the right skills and experience for your job and invites them to apply. You can even add screening questions to your job listing so you can filter candidates. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. To try ZipRecruiter for free, our listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. That's ZipRecruiter.com/GORDON. ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Hey, thanks for spending time with us. Despite all the attention given to phishing attacks, and that's with a PH, phishing, and high-profile hacks, email still remains the number one place where victims fall prey to bad guys. Jeff Graham, technology columnist at USA Today, has been speaking with security pros. Jeff, explain.
I was at the RSA convention this week, which is where all the security pros go to talk about scams and new ways to offset them. And universally, they say nothing comes close to email. There's a bunch of other scams in the works, but email is the most prevalent because we get more of it than any other form of communication. And it's so cheap to send out a bogus email. $65 will get you to hundreds of thousands of people.
Wow. Is that right? $65 and you can purchase 50,000, 100,000 emails and just blast somebody? Wow.
Yep.
And texting is not that cheap?
Gordon, how many emails do you get a day versus how many texts?
Fair enough. Okay. Many more emails. Okay.
Like many, many, many more, right?
Yep.
So it's just the bulk is the winning, and I don't, you know, you could do a Facebook post, I guess, but it's hard to get every, you know, they have to become your friend and all that sort of stuff. Email, you could just email anybody.
All right, and so this sets up really the basic phishing scam, which you click a link you should not be clicking that's contained in your email because...
Well, let's be topical.
Okay.
Barbara Cochran from Shark Tank just is out. She's out nearly $400,000. Her bookkeeper got a bogus email from somebody saying that they were Barbara Cochran's assistant. One letter was misspelled. The bookkeeper didn't see it. Click this link to send me money, and she did. And Barbara Cochran is now out nearly $400,000. That's the basic fish. Anything in an email that says, click this link or send me money, ding, 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 ding. No. You check. The first thing is check the web address. So if it says Google is confirming that your account is your own account, look at the address. Does it come from Google or does it come from Google services? There's usually something wrong with every email address. And if you just take a look, you could find it out in a second.
Yeah. Boy, if you're a company, right, I mean, you're only as strong as your weakest link.
I went to a seminar yesterday morning at RSA about phishing audio, about fake audio, on how easy it is for me to create an audio of fake Gordon Deal. 5 minutes of audio is all I need to put it into a computer and take all the words out of context and turn it into a different sentence.
Wow, is that right?
Yes.
Like lift it off of SoundCloud or some platform, you mean?
Anything.
Jeez.
Anything. Any place where there's audio online, whether that be YouTube, SoundCloud, TuneIn, I mean, whatever, that's all they need. And so now you have to, and they gave the story. It really happened is a fake phone call to the bookkeeper and said, wire this money right now, immediately, and the person did.
Wow.
And we're talking $200,000.
We're speaking with Jeff Graham, technology columnist at USA Today, also host of a podcast called Talking Tech. His piece is called Email Still Beats Text for Hackers Phishing for Your Data. So along the lines of the headline of your piece, is there a point you think where texting actually catches up or closes the gap significantly with email in terms of phishing scams?
Apparently it's a lot easier to get a email address than it is to get a phone number.
Okay.
So I don't see texting catching up because the volume is just not there.
Yeah. In the meantime, the criminals continue to put more effort into this than we do in terms of defense.
Right. Just use common sense. Anybody sends you a link, think about it. Or write back and say, is this who I think it is? Because the scammer will never write back to you. Or call them. Or just do a little investigation. It's a pain, but you sort of have to do it on the audio scam. If you get a call from your boss saying send $400,000 to such and such a vendor, say, I'm going to call you right back. Call back and see if he/she answers the phone.
Thanks, Jeff. Jeff Graham, technology columnist at USA Today, also host of a podcast called Talking Tech. 21 minutes after the hour on this weekend.
Nobody's gonna stop me. No, nothing is beyond me. I'm coming at you faster. No stopping, doesn't matter.
Now that Human Resources VP Meg Ward has Kronos for HR, payroll, talent, and time, she's totally owning it at work. She even has her own hype song.
I'ma blow it up now. Hey, I'm a body in motion. Hey, making waves like the ocean. Hey,
my workforce is really diverse. Different hours, different skill sets, different pay grades.
There's nobody like me. I dare you, bring it on. Bring it on. I'ma show you all how.
We're motivating and engaging the right people every step of the way.
Kronos, HR solutions for the modern workforce. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger.
Thanks for being with us. Your workouts could be on the way to getting shorter. A new group of fitness clubs based around the idea of biohacking say their short workouts provide the strength benefits of traditional weights, but in a fraction of the time. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Imagine working out for only 45 minutes a week and getting results. Sound impossible? Some say it's not. Here with more, Hillary Potkowitz of the Wall Street Journal, who has profiled a new type of in-and-out gym. Hillary, what are these gyms all about?
Well, they call themselves biohacking or smart gyms, and their idea is to take away all of the wasted time and effort and make workouts as efficient as possible.
All right, how do we do that?
That's the idea.
Yeah, how do we do that?
They say doing it with data technology and hyper-efficient movement.
So are they using machines? How does that work out?
Yes. A few companies out there, they've created these high-tech machines that basically pack a bunch of exercises into one. So let's say, for example, you were doing a chest press. on a regular machine, you'd push out the weights, and then gravity would help you a lot in getting the machine back to the start position, right? In these machines, you have to push out the weights, and then you actually have to pull it back as well. And they don't use weights. They use these computerized motors, and so they're basically calibrating the force by the effort you give in. So if you push really hard, it'll resist really hard. And if you push gently, it will resist gently. And the same thing in the opposite direction.
So Hillary, give us an example of some of these gyms. Where are they? And are they just gyms that feature these kinds of equipment and nothing else?
So the gyms, they're pretty new. I mean, I would say that over the past couple of years, they've been opening up pretty much all over the country. There are a couple of chains, or they're independent, and they tend to be small. They'll have like a small footprint, maybe, you know, a thousand, like a storefront, 1,000 square feet, and they'll have usually just a handful of pieces of equipment. There'll be a couple of these high-tech strength training machines. There are also these artificial intelligence driven bicycles, sort of stationary bike that is similar. They've like calibrated it so the harder you ride, the harder it will resist you. And the whole idea is to do like 40-second sprints. And they say that that can give you enough cardio to last you like a week, supposedly.
We're speaking with Hillary Potkowitz of the Wall Street Journal. I was going to say, it sounds like in reading your article that it would be pretty good for strength benefits, but when it comes to aerobic benefits, only a couple of minutes seems like it wouldn't do the trick.
It seems that way. I mean, a lot of, you know, these companies will say that there's plenty of science behind it, and they talk about, you know, lowering your stress hormones and things like that. You know, it's hard to say. I talked to some medical experts who say, like, you know, maybe that, you know, if it's someone who pretty much sits at a desk all the time, this might, a workout like this might be enough to keep them in like a basic level of fitness. But there's so much more to exercise than just the building of the muscles, right? There's the mental aspects of it. There's, you know, getting in the zone. Like they just talk about how there's so many other aspects of exercise that these micro workouts just don't take into consideration. So, you know, some medical experts say the jury's still out, but the people who are behind this movement say that, you know, anything that gets people exercising is better than nothing.
Hillary, do we know anything about injuries?
The people behind the proponents of this movement talk about the safety of the machines. They say one of the other benefits, especially for, you know, older people, is that these machines are carefully calibrated so that you can't lift more than your body can handle, for example, that it controls the movement so that it takes away some of the balance issues that you might have in free weights, for example. So that's one thing on the plus side, I guess, is that, you know, they say that they tend to be safer than traditional weight training equipment. But like many exercise fads, you know, time will tell.
All right. This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Hillary Potkowitz. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Let me tell you about my new favorite way to pass the time while commuting. It's the app called Blinkist. Blinkist works on your phone, your tablet, or your web browser. Blinkist takes the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books and whittles it down to just 15 minutes. Successful people like business leaders are well known for reading self-improvement books. I just finished listening to Snowball, a Warren Buffett biography. Listen to Blinkist while commuting or maybe exercising, even while you're waiting for your kids to finish practice. Blinkist has the latest titles from bestseller lists as well as the classic nonfiction titles you always meant to read. I also like listening to some of the history titles since I never had much good history in school. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/morning to try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/morning to start your free 7-day trial. You'll also save 25%, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/morning. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, financial psychology regarding coronavirus. Also, too much slush makes for bad ice fishing in Minnesota. and the World War II vet nicknamed Harmonica Pete. That story in about 20 minutes. Running for office is a germ fest, and being an expert doesn't always help. The novel coronavirus has arrived in an election year, and as candidates prepare to do what candidates do, personal space is hard to come by on the campaign trail. Catherine Lyons, reporter at CQ Roll Call, has been speaking with doctors who are also senators and representatives on Capitol Hill. Catherine, what are you hearing?
We're hearing basically the same thing we've been hearing all along. Wash your hands, keep your hands out of your face, keep the touching others to a minimum, pretty much.
And then, as you said, or one of the folks in your story said, it's not always easy to keep your hands away from your face, especially if you're somebody, say, who wears glasses.
Yeah, and even if you aren't somebody that I don't wear glasses, and I constantly touch my face, and I'm not a huge germaphobe, so I feel like I'm very at risk for acquiring and spreading germs. I'm always touching my face. I feel like it's pretty automatic, right?
Yeah.
We put our hands in our faces when we're tired, whenever we feel like it.
All right. So who is saying what that you talked to?
Well, we've got Cassidy. He was a gastroenterologist, and he put a nice and colorful creative twist to the handshake. He was joking that the crawfish boil handshake is an alternative, where it's basically another name for the elbow bump. When you've got your fingers all saucy from a big crawfish feast, right? He's making elbow bumps cool again. And then we've got Greg Murphy. He was a urologist, and he suggested a foot bump, which I have yet to see on the Hill, but maybe I'll bring it to the Hill. Maybe I'll try it out. It seems like the least amount of effort, right?
Right. Although you kind of, you know, with an elbow bump or a fist bump, you know, you can indicate what you're about to do, and people recognize it pretty much worldwide, like a high five. How do you indicate what you're about to do with a foot bump?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I'll have to try it out and get back to you. Maybe just kind of like look down at the other person's foot. That might work. I don't know. That might be weird, though.
We're speaking with Catherine Lyons, reporter at CQ Roll Call. Her piece is called "They're Doctors, They're Politicians. They Were Using Hand Sanitizer Before It Was Cool." Who requires hand sanitization before even entering the office? Was that Mark Green from Tennessee?
That was Mark Green. Although they all seem very partial to hand sanitizer. Nobody expressed any disdain for hand sanitization. I even asked if you could over hand sanitize your hands. And considering that we're not doing it, normal people aren't doing it as much as surgeons, doctors, people in hospitals, it's going to be very hard to over sanitize. One of my concerns was also the dryness that comes with hand sanitizer. There are hand sanitizers that come with moisturizer. There's hand soaps that come with moisturizer. If you dry out your hands, you're more susceptible to infection and spreading it because it's cracking, right? So I think keeping your hands moisturized is important. Now I sound like a doctor. I feel like I could do this, Gordon. This is easy. Anybody can go to med school.
Thanks, Catherine. Catherine Lyons, reporter at CQ Roll Call. 22 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. If you were going to design a lab experiment to test investors' nerves, recent stock market activity would provide a nearly perfect template. Think about it. We have a virus without a vaccine that's spreading rapidly, but nobody knows how rapidly, which is damaging the global economy, but nobody knows how badly. How do you process this psychologically? We're joined by personal finance expert Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, what should we keep in mind?
So when you look at the market and you see it gyrating up and down like crazy, people should immediately realize that there is one thing in their lives that they cannot control, and that is the stock market. The stock market is going to do whatever it wants to do. So instead, as an investor, what you need to do is focus on the things that you can control. So what can you control? You can control how much you save on a regular basis. You can control your investment costs. You can control how much your portfolio generates in terms of tax bills. You can control the amount of risk you take. But at a time like this, the one thing that is most important to control is your emotional reaction to the market's volatility. That, more than anything, is the top priority for investors at a time like this.
I like the one point you made where you said something along the lines of, if you were told at one point that given the market's recent successes, especially in 2019, that the markets were going to go sideways for about 4 months, you'd probably shrug it off. However, here many people are panicking over a handful of bad days with stocks.
You're absolutely right, Gordon. I mean, we're now back roughly where we were in October, but of course we went up and then we came back down, and that's what investors find so unnerving. Well, what they find unnerving is the down part.
Yeah.
And the reason we find it so unnerving is because of a mental mistake that experts in behavioral finance call recency bias. So we become fixated on whatever the market has done most recently, and we tend to take that and extrapolate it into the future. So last week, when we had the market dropping substantially, a lot of people looked at that and said, it's gone down a lot, it's going to go down a whole lot more. And the people, you know, who were already freaked out, the result is that, you know, a fair number of them, I suspect, sold out, locked in their losses, and are probably at this point kicking themselves.
I'm speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com, and he's written a piece on that site called Don't Lose It. You mentioned, too, loss aversion, and it's so true that we feel more pain from losses than we do with gains. It's almost like sports. You know, you celebrate that championship, and you work so hard, but when you lose one, oh, it's just the worst thing ever. You can't even enjoy the one you won.
Yeah, so coming back to behavioral finance, you know, what experts in behavioral finance have found is that the pain we get from losses is more than twice as great as the pleasure we get from gains. So losses really, really sting. Now, the good news is, because losses sting so much, and we really don't want to accept that we have lost money, for a significant swath of the investing population, the reaction to a loss is to say, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to freeze in place, because the last thing I want to do is sell my losing positions and admit I made a mistake, because that would be so painful. But in certain people, you know, this loss aversion coupled with the recency bias, the way we're extrapolating what's happened most recently in the market, will cause some people to panic and sell. And of course, you know, what we know from history is that at a time like this, you shouldn't be selling. What you should be doing is continuing to invest in the stock market, and if you've got the cash to spare, you should actually pick up the amount that you're contributing to your 401k plan every month or to your IRA every month. This is a buying opportunity.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, right? Stacks of resumes, a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only need to go to one place to get it done, a place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. You can even add screening questions to your job listing so you can filter candidates and focus on the best ones. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, to try ZipRecruiter for free, our listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Hey, glad you're with us. In northern Minnesota, ice fishing is big business. Normally, resorts plow fluffy snow off several feet of solid ice to create vast networks of roads for anglers to use. This year, early snows, though, just about killed the season. Joe Barrett, senior Midwest correspondent at the Wall Street Journal, says the bad conditions forced resorts to cancel reservations, ask for low-interest state loans, and call on every bit of ingenuity at their disposal to salvage what they could. He visited Lake Winnipegoshish. Joe, what did you find?
Yeah, this was just a terrible year up in northern Minnesota. Ice fishing is a huge business up there, and they just got too much snow. It blanketed the ice early on, and so the ice wouldn't grow because the cold air couldn't get to it. And then eventually they got a huge storm right after Christmas, and that cracked the ice, which allowed the water to seep in, and you basically had about 2 feet of slush out there. So it's just a disaster at the start of the busiest time of the year for these ice fishing resorts.
Wow. All right, so you visited this Lake Winnipegoshish in Minnesota.
That's right, yeah.
Explain some of the things that are going on there.
Well, the resorts, you know, were really stuck. They had to cancel some reservations. They had to tell the people that normally would come and drive out onto the ice and, you know, pay like a day fee that they just couldn't do it because there wasn't enough ice out there. Normally, by January, you'd have like 2 feet of beautiful ice, and then any snow that came along, they would use like a regular snow plow, clear it off, and they would, you know, each resort would create about 20 or 30 miles of networks of roads for people to drive around and check different fishing spots and, you know, set up their equipment. But this year, you know, right when everybody was coming in to catch walleye and northern pike, they just really couldn't get on the ice because of all this snow. Eventually, there would be like a frozen layer on top of the slush, and you could get like a tracked vehicle out there, but not like a car. So some of the resorts were like shuttling people out to the fish houses on these little tracked vehicles, and they were calling it Uber on the ice, just, you know, to give it a catchy name. But you know, they weren't getting the big numbers of people just because the ice couldn't support it.
Jeez. We're speaking with Joe Barrett, senior Midwest correspondent at the Wall Street Journal. His piece is called On Thin Ice, Too Much Slush Makes Ice Fishing a Risky Business. He visited northern Minnesota, specifically a lake called Lake Winnipegoshish. Reading your report, it made it seem like part of the business during this winter was trucks having to pull other trucks out of the cracked ice or surface giving way.
So these guys were really, you know, still trying to put their roads in, and you know, they would go sometimes to just one or two trucks, like truck lengths, and then break into the ice. They'd have to get pulled out and then wait a couple days for that soft spot to harden up again. Then they'd drive over that hard spot, go as far as they could, and crash back through. So, you know, it was tough. I mean, there weren't trucks going down to the bottom of the lake. There was, you know, enough sort of floaty material out there to keep them up on the surface, but, you know, they would keep getting stuck because of so much slush.
Thanks, Joe. Joe Barrett, senior Midwest correspondent at the Wall Street Journal, visiting Lake Winnipegoshish. I just wanted to say that again. 6 minutes in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. We'll finish with this. A World War II veteran named Pete Dupree got to travel to his Mecca earlier this month, as he calls it, West Point Military Academy. The 96-year-old was invited to the Army versus Navy basketball game. He wasn't there, though, just as a spectator. He was there to perform with his harmonica. CBS News says Mr. Dupree has become known as Harmonica Pete. He got his first harmonica as a boy during the Great Depression. Despite having no musical knowledge, he taught himself how to play and has kept a harmonica with him ever since. He's brought his trusty instrument with him around the world, too. He even played it while serving as a World War II Army medic during the Battle of the Bulge. Now Mr. Dupree travels to sporting events, funerals, and parades to play. At West Point, the crowd went wild when he finished. He took his hat off, basked in the praise, and sat back in his wheelchair to be led off the court. His daughter, by the way, helps book the gigs, and his son, Michael, gets him to where he's performing. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.